guys.
Sorry, I'm late. K2RIW here.
At this time, we begin the TICnet. See if I got this thing set right. I think I do. Okay. For those who want to check into the TICnet, give me your call letters and name. Start right now. K2RIW listed.
This is KC2, Queen Yankee Whiskey. Name is Joe, and yes.
We got you, Joe. Anyone else?
This is N1YDY. Name is Hank. No.
I think Hank said no. Anyone else with a check-in with a question or a comment? Name and call letters, please.
KD2CMQ. Neil, yes.
We got you, Neil. Anyone else?
KD2CPI. Marty.
You're going to have to give that one to me phonetically. And name again, too. I think you said Marty.
Hello, Delta 2. Charlie Tango, India. Arnie.
We got you, Arnie. Anyone else?
S2N. With the spaceship port, Paul.
Good evening, Dick. John.
We got you, Paul. Was there another person checking in after Arnie?
PHY, Jim, and yes.
Okay, we got you, Jim. A little bit noisy. Anyone else?
KD2, Echo Whiskey Oscar.
Echo Whiskey Oscar, please tell me your name.
His name is Joe.
We got you, Joe. And one last call. Anyone else to check in with a question or a comment? Give me your name and call letters. Okay. Joe, number one. You're number one on the runway. On the more brief introductory here that I'm trying out. KC2, Quebec Yankee Whiskey. Go right ahead, Joe. K2LIW. What would you like to discuss tonight?
Yeah, roger that. Thank you. Hi, everybody. Quick question. With my transceiver, I'm going to use I think it's called a 1.1 inline choke. I don't know if I'm saying it right, or a bobbin or a balloon or something like that. Do you put it near the transceiver, or you put it near the antenna base? That's my question. Because it doesn't say anything about it on the instructions on how to install that inline choke hold.
And one further question, Joe. Is the actual antenna that you're installing the ballon on, is that a dipole-like antenna?
Oh, sorry about that. I forgot to tell you. It's called a MSJ Forsman Big Stick Whip. It's like a portable whip. But I tried it a couple of days ago, and I couldn't believe it. On 20 meters, it worked so good. I have it out on the porch. That's where I'm going to install it. On the, I think it's called a Big Stick portable whip that extends out up to like about like 20 foot.
Sounds like that antenna is really cooking, Joe. Okay, you called it a 1.1. Most people will call it a 1:1. In other words, the impedance ratio on ballons can be 4:1, 2:1. 1:1, and you're describing a 1:1 ballon. And it's pronounced ballon, B-A-L-U-N is the usual spelling, but it's got other spellings, and it's a contraction of balanced to unbalanced. It's not so true of your big stick, but dipole-like antennas are really, the antenna itself is very balanced, but the coax cable is not. It's a fancy way of saying that the an ordinary coax cable, you could assume that all the signal is on the center conductor and almost no signal is on the outer conductor. It's an exaggeration, but you could assume that as far as figuring out how it works. And the way a guy usually connects a dipole is they'll connect the center conductor to one half of the dipole and the shield to the other half of the dipole. The dipole itself is a truly balanced antenna. I mean, you think it's a half wavelength long. Mother Nature says it's a quarter wave time your transmission line is generating 2 volts. She wants a plus 1 volt on the right side of the dipole and minus 1 volt on the left side of the dipole, so that it's a neutral device, and that's what happens on the first half cycle, and those two voltages are the same magnitude but reversed on the second half cycle. Well, when you hook that transmission line, the coax cable, to your dipole, and the dipole tries to force that balance, the bottom line is that the dipole will force some signal to flow down the outside of the coax cable. Ordinarily, the signal is all contained on the inside. And so now, your outside of your cable becomes hot. If you install the right kind of a balun right at the antenna, it tends to act like an RF choke. Let me drop. So that any signal that wants to flow down the outside of the cable gets stopped right at that balun. In your case, where it's a big stick, and it's not so obvious whether or not the antenna is trying to act in a balanced manner or an unbalanced manner, a ground plane-like antenna, your radials are sort of neutral, and the radiator, the thing in the center, is the thing that's hot. But you almost never will lose any performance by putting in a balun. It might be belt and suspenders. You might not absolutely need it, but it's a good thing to do. Almost always, the balun is installed right at the antenna. You want to stop any signal from flowing down the outside of your coax cable right at the source. So I'm not sure whether you've used that balun yet, but it's not going to hurt. I recommend you do it, and I recommend you put it as close to the antenna as you can get. And other than that, let us know, are you continuing to get all this great DX? Maybe Mother Nature's sunspot cycle is helping you a little bit and giving you some good ionospheric propagation, Joe. And how high above the ground have you installed your big stick? Maybe you're doing it from the balcony of your apartment, or maybe you're doing it from the roof of the garage, or maybe you're doing it right at the ground. KC2, QIW, K2RIW. Go ahead, Joe.
Yeah, Roger, Roger. It's about a good 80 foot high off the porch over here. And I also have another antenna. I think it's called Alpha Delta fan dipole antenna. So when I have time, I'm gonna set that up. Cause what I did was I bought a whole new setup. I picked up the FT950 A2 and Polestar antenna tuner, the AT2K, and Polestar. I don't know why they're so expensive, but who knows, you know? Yeah. So to answer your question, yeah, that big stick, portable big stick from MFJ. It's about a good 80 foot high.
Does that mean that you are on the 8th floor of that apartment building you live in, Joe? Go ahead.
Yeah, Roger. Like almost like the 3rd floor. So yeah, almost like the 3rd floor. So it's a good like maybe like 60 foot high.
Well done. That altitude is helping. To be on the conservative side, I would recommend you put a balun on each one of those antennas, your big stick, the fan dipole, and so on. And the one-to-one balun is a good thing to start off with. So the main reason you're doing that is to make sure no RF current is flowing down the outside of the cable. When RF current flows down the outside of the cable because of just a raw fitting of the cable to the dipole-like antenna, it's not a showstopper, but it usually can create quite a bit of grief. Stand by a second. Because that RF flowing down the outside of the cable can increase television interference. It can, if that cable is flowing by the apartment of your neighbor, it could interfere with some of his electronics. So usually it's undesirable. And if you don't have another one-to-one balun available to you, a poor man's balun is to take a few turns of the coax cable near the antenna, 2, 3, 4 turns, a couple of feet in diameter, and that represents an RF choke. either held that, those turns together by way of tie wraps or tape. And that's a poor man's RF choke, or a poor man's balance. And it gives you almost no insertion loss, and it can stop a lot of current from flowing down the outside of the cable. So if you don't have the other balance ready to go, that's another way to go. When it comes to antenna tuners, the better made ones are kind of expensive. The better made ones have got a great big choke inside and transmitting rated capacitors, maybe for either the 100 watt or the 500 watt or the 1000 watt level. And so some of the components in there, let me drop them. Some of the components in there are kind of expensive, and if the manufacturer does a good job and if he's got a good reputation, he thinks he can start charge a high price and people will pay it and be happy. Antenna tuners are good. You're going to find from time to time various people you talk to who will tell you an antenna tuner has a lot of insertion loss. With rare exception, and don't believe them, a well-made antenna tuner has essentially zero loss and can do a beautiful job of doing impedance matching and keeping the transmitter happy. And if the transmitter receives a 50-ohm load because you've properly adjusted the antenna tuner, or maybe it's an automatic one. And by the way, some of the expensive ones are the automatic ones. If it makes sure that the transmitter sees a 50-ohm load because of the operation of the antenna tuner, that usually increases the power output of the transmitter, increases the linearity, creates less splatter. In general, it's a good thing to do. So it sounds like you've got a good setup there. A little bit on the expensive side, but hey, Joe, you're worth it. And let us know in the future how that's all working. KC2QIW, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Yeah, roger that. Yeah, thank you for the help, and I learned a lot today. Is there any books that you could recommend to me, easy understanding about, that we just discussed about, what we just discussed about? Back to the net.
About the best book I could recommend on antenna theory is the ARRL antenna book. I think it's around $20-$25. A lot of good information in there. Also, the Radio Amateur's Handbook, the early chapters have got a lot of good information. But the antenna book, it's not a quick read, it's not simple, but still, antenna theory is a little bit on the complicated side. And that's the book that does about the best job I know of explaining how the antenna works. You'd be amazed how many commercial organizations that have a antenna development department, you'd be amazed how many times the ARRL antenna book, which is kind of a ham radio book, although it's a little bit on the fat side, you'd be amazed how many of the antenna engineers, professional engineers, have that book sitting on their shelf and refer to it rather often. As I said, it's not very expensive, a lot of good information, and nowadays it comes with a CD-ROM that gives you even a lot more information and various modeling programs and whatever. I'd start off with that one, Joe. Need any further fill on that? KC2QIW, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Yeah, okay, yeah, thank you, and thank you for the help. But yeah, I'll look into that, and I guess I'll pass it over to the next station out there, and this is great. I learned a lot tonight. This is KC2, Queen, Yankee, Whiskey, and I hope my audio is working good today, because a couple of weeks ago, you guys were reporting that you hear a lot of background noise, a lot of static. So hopefully my 2-meter radio is working tonight.
Sure is, Joe, and I'm glad you asked that question. Yeah, you're essentially dead full quieting, good audio, good carrier. You sound good. So whatever you're doing, keep doing it. And come back and let us know how that all works out. And you're allowed to keep asking these questions because the schools we go to do a rather poor job of explaining antennas. And an awful lot of what goes on inside of an antenna is not common sense. You have to hear it a couple of times in order for some of the crazy information to make sense. So come back and ask us some more questions next week, Joe. Neil's the next guy. Kilo Delta 2, Charlie Mike Quebec. Go right ahead, Neil. KQRIW in the TechNet. My name is Dick.
Hi, Dick. I'm in the planning stages of putting an outside dipole in, and I was going to feed it with balanced line. However, I've got a few quick questions about balanced line, and I understand the time constraints, so whatever fits in. Basically, I have two questions. One is, to get to the outside from the equipment in my shack, I have to go over a lot of metal, air conditioning ducts, etc. So the recommendations that I've seen so far is two pieces of coax with the shielding tied together to a common ground. However, my understanding of why balanced line works so well is that is the interaction of the fields between the two conductors. And if you have shielding around each conductor, grounded shielding, wouldn't that kind of just wipe out the interaction between the two fields? And would I be just get no more advantage than running a piece of coax with a ballon at the end of it? And the second question is...
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
Yeah, that timeout occurred, Neil, because you didn't wait for the four beeps when I turned it back over to you. And I was able to hear Neil on the input, so what he was asking during the time the machine was timed out is if he's only got a short piece of open wire line, is he still going to get a benefit? Okay. Coax cable, or any kind of a transmission line, only has loss because of its length and its dB per 100 feet, so to speak. In other words, every kind of transmission line... Stand by for a second. I'm hearing another receiver in the house. I just figured out what it is. I got to turn it off. Stand by. Okay. Didn't want all that noise to go out over the air. Every kind of transmission line has a rating in loss of dB per 100 feet. A piece of RG8 cable, for instance, at 2 meters, probably has something in the vicinity of 1.5 dB, maybe 2 dB per 100 feet. If you used open wire line, the numbers tend to be a lot lower. So as much open wire line as you can use, the overall transmission line will be lower in loss. That's one piece of good news. And second of all, to get the full benefit of the open wire line, you have to feed it in a thoroughly balanced manner. That really means that of those two wires on the open wire line, if at one instant of time the right-hand wire is at plus 10 volts, at that exact same instant, the left-hand line should be minus 10 volts on the first half cycle. And then you reverse those polarities on the second half cycle. That's the way you really feed open wire line correctly. And some of the antenna tuners have a built-in network that will feed open wire line, and some of them do not. Some of them have only a coax output. As such, you've got to create some kind of a balanced to unbalanced device. You have to put some kind of a network in there that properly goes from the coax cable over to the balanced line. And whether or not you do that outside the house by running a piece of coax cable inside the house until it leaves, then put some kind of a device right outside the house to properly launch the signal into the open wire line, and then the rest of the system can be the open wire line. That's one possible approach. Let me drop. Another possible approach is to use two pieces of coax cable, just as you indicated. The fact that the sum of your system is going to be two pieces of coax cable side by side, where you're feeding the two center conductors as if they were open wire line, and the two shields are brought together and just grounded, it looks like you would have extra loss. Yes, you will. However, because loss is only a function of length, and the total length of your cable inside the house usually is very short compared to the amount of cable transmission line outside of the house, you still come out ahead. And so the dB per 100 feet of the coax cable inside the house, a little bit lossier, but you're not using very many feet of it. And the nice thing about the coax cable in the house is that you can usually make pretty sharp bends, you can lay it against wire, you can route it any way you want to, whereas to get the full benefit of open wire line, you do have a lot of restrictions. There shouldn't be metal nearby, you shouldn't make sharp bends and so on. So you've got a couple of choices as I see it, Neil. Let me drop. So whether you decide to run the open wire line as close as you can to the transmitter and run the open wire line going through the wall outside the house, doable but difficult. It's a lot easier to run coax cable through the wall than open wire through the wall. People have done it, but the total number of feet of transmission line in the house is so small, you don't have to worry about that. The RF energy itself really doesn't care the fact that some of it is going through shielded pair of coax cable side by side, and some of it's going through open wire. It's only a function of loss and whether or not you're properly feeding it, properly creating this differential voltage, if you know what I mean. I think I would go the way you're tempted to do, a pair of coax cables to leave the house, and then and then launch the open wire line right there. As long as those two coax cables are going to something that can do impedance matching, like an antenna tuner, I think you can make it work out very well. If it's not going to an antenna tuner, then you're going to have to be a lot more careful in how you launch the signal, how you do impedance matching, and so on. Open wire line tends to be 300, 450, or 600 ohm impedance. Dipole-like antennas tend to be around 70 ohm impedance. And at first that sounds like it's a big mismatch. Let me drop. And if you did connect the open wire line directly to a dipole, yes, there is a big mismatch there. But and now you're going to have some standing wave ratio on the open wire line. Under normal circumstances, transmission line running a higher standing wave ratio has more insertion loss. But because the insertion loss starts off so low an open wire line, that's quite often not a problem. But it probably will require an antenna tuner. And there's also ways in which you can put a impedance matching device right at the dipole. If you're for instance using 450 ohm open wire line, it's not too difficult to put an impedance matching device that's 450 ohms on one side and 70 ohms on the other side, and that's a little black box, so to speak, right at the dipole, properly feeding the dipole. Lots and lots of ways to go. It'd be nice if I can say this is the best way and all the others are terrible. The good news, as I see it, Neil, is you've got a number of ways that will all work as long as you carry out the fine details. You're allowed to ask a lot more questions on this, not only this week, but next week. And because I made my introduction so brief and we got a lot of extra time tonight, I'm allowed to spend some time with you, if you know what I mean, Neil. Case 2, Charlie Mike Quebec, K2RIW and TechNet. Wait for the four beeps.
It's DTZ with a comment.
Yes, stand by, Neil. Hal has used open wire line a lot more years than I have. Let's see how his recommendation of feeding it. You got it, Hal.
Dick. Yeah, what you can also do is run a T-match. Have a full half-wave of antenna, horizontal antenna, and just T-match the open wire line. Come up to the antenna, bring the open wire line out from each side until you have the sweet impedance point and drive it that way, like an old bazooka match.
And if I take Hal's suggestion and then push it a little bit further, if you make the dipole a folded dipole, in other words, something like 300 ohm twin leader, a high power equivalent of it, is the actual dipole, and you just make a gap in the twin lead in the center on only one of the wires and feed the open wire line there. A folded dipole tends to run around 300 ohm impedance. Now, that's so close to the impedance of the open wire line that no real impedance matching is required. As you can see, Neil, the problem you've got is there's too many choices. Try each one of them, as I see it. In your particular environment, one of them will seem more easy to do than the others. KD2, CMQ, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Yes, Dick, thanks. You answered most of my questions, but wouldn't the matching be dealt with my antenna tuner? Over.
90% of that is true. The antenna tuner, which usually is located in the shack, will make the transmitter perfectly happy. It'll see 50 ohms. However, if there is a significant impedance mismatch, on the transmission line beyond the antenna tuner. And the transmission line will run a little bit higher in loss. If this was the best of all worlds, you'd have a remotely controlled antenna tuner right at the antenna. Now the transmission line would never see any standing wave ratio. That's the best of all worlds. Very few of us do that. A thoroughly remotely controlled antenna tuner is a lot more expensive, a lot more rigmarole to properly feeding it. And so when you've got a low-loss transmission line, like open wire line, the fact that it is running some extra standing wave ratio is really nothing to lose a lot of sleep over. It may increase its insertion loss by 20%, but because the open wire line is so low in loss to begin with, we're spinning in the ocean and we shouldn't worry about it. So keep using the antenna tuner, and in the shack, it's going to give you 90% of the benefit you're ever going to get, if you know what I mean. Back to you, Neil. K2LIW. Wait for the beeps.
Okay, the only thing that I had left out, for simplicity's sake, that now seems to be important, is this is going to be a Van dipole for multiple frequencies. So I imagine that would make a T-match rather complicated. Over.
It sure would. The good news about a fan dipole is that it's very easy to cover multiple bands, and if you decide to tune each one of those fan sections to the center of your particular band or the edge of your particular band, you may want to adjust your fan dipole so it gives the lowest possible loss at the high end of 20 meters and the low end of 40 meters, if you know what I mean. And the nice thing about the fan dipole is the adjustment of those individual wires is almost independent, very easy to tune. As such, if you take your open wire line, feed it directly to the center of the fan dipole, which on each one of those bands is close to 70 ohms, and maybe your open wire line is 450, big deal, a little bit of ISWA there. But it's got such a low loss, your antenna tuner is going to accommodate that. Don't lose any sleep over it. It's going to work like a charm. And the nice thing about the antenna tuner is that it's got a separate set of settings for each one of those bands. You either memorize it or have the machine automatically memorize that, and therefore switching between the bands will be very fast. It's going to be quite efficient. Don't worry about it. You're going to get people that will tell you that, hey, your open wire line is running a 4-to-1 BISWA. Open wire line can tolerate a 20-to-1 BISWA and work like a charm. So don't worry about it. And go ahead and try it. Nothing bad is going to happen, if you know what I mean, Neil. KD2CM2, K2RIW in the TechNet.
KC2QIQ in the continent.
Go ahead, Glenn.
A quick thing, on a fan dipole, little known little trick with a fan dipole is if you want to do a T-match and you have, let's say, 10 meters, 15, 20, 40, and 80 all on your fan dipole, do the T-match on the 20-meter dipole and all the other bands fall in. KC2QIQ.
That's not a very well-known secret you've discovered, Glenn. Where did you first hear about that? And where can we read a little bit more? Is it something you invented? Sounds like a goodie. KC2QIQ, K2LIW in the TechNet.
I wouldn't say that I invented it, but I discovered it while tuning them. Basically, I was trying different methods of putting tuners and other things and matching, and I was finding that there was some difficulty. Do you want to keep on cutting the ends of your fan dipole to get it to fall in, or do you just want to go for a length? So in other words, if you measure up the lengths and you get them into the standard formula for, 468 divided by the frequency in megahertz, and, you know, just basically cut them to length, join them on a center insulator, and then now the trick is, how do you tie them together? Well, basically, you tie them together on the insulator at one point, and you try to bring the ends as close together as possible, although anything within reason, like 5 inches, is okay when you let it drop. Now, the next trick was, how do you find and match all of the bands all together? When do you put do you tie the wire line or the balun in the middle of the fan dipole, towards the top, towards the bottom? Where do you get the best match? And anybody who's ever tried attaching feed lines to this thing realizes that it's kind of sensitive in how you run the wire up the side. So when I was putting a balun on, I found out, as Hal had suggested, you you put the, when you're attaching across the wire line, move the leads further along one of the fans. And it just so turns out that 20 meters, if you do it right in the middle, across the 20 meter length, all the other bands fall right in and they tune up beautifully. I found it almost by accident and experimentation did. K2RIW, KC2QIQ.
Now, you have a good mental picture of what you've done, Glenn. The words you've used have only given the listeners a partial picture of what you've done. Have you ever considered making a diagram and submitting this to Bernie's website, K2 Yankee Oscar? He's the guy who collects all these articles so that everybody can be on the same page on the TechNet at the same time. So have you ever considered making a diagram of that? And it sounds like it's the beginning of a good article. I think you've got a good discovery there, Glenn. KC2QIQ, K2LAW, and TechNet.
Yeah, it's already done, Dick. I've sent it out to quite a few people who've asked about the fan dipoles and how to implement them. And over time, and I, you know, suggest some balance and some of the wire lengths, how to cut and trim the wires, what kind of, how to put, assemble the center insulator, and basically how to attach the match. But yeah, it already exists. Maybe one of these days I'll get a hold of Bernie and send something over to him. KC2QIQ.
You don't even have to get a hold of Bernie. Just simply submit it to K2IO at the email address that you see on QIZ.com. He will automatically put it on his website, which is Bernie@HuntFamily.org, I think it is, or is it HuntFamily.com, I keep forgetting. Anyhow, he will automatically put it there if you just simply send that email to him, Glenn. So I hope you get a chance to do that, because it sounds like you've got a goodie, and I don't think you should keep that light under a bushel basket. I think you should spread it around. Any further questions on all of the above, Neil? KD2CMQ, K2RIW, and the TechNet.
And if you get a chance, shoot me a copy of that also, please.
I would very much like a copy of that. My email is on QRZ. Or through Limark. But thank you, Dick. That was an awful lot of information, and I feel much better about it now. I think I'm on the right track. Thanks a lot. Back to you.
Well, you're definitely on the right track, Neil. We amateurs are extremely good at experimenting with antennas. We don't build our rigs anymore on 80 to 10 meters. Now, the guys on the microwave frequency still do. And with a week's salary, you can buy a rig that would take you more than a year to build, so we don't do that anymore. But when it comes to antennas and tinkering and fitting it into our particular piece of property and getting the best performance in our particular town, at our particular altitude of the apartment building and whatever, or the restrictions of the homeowners association, those kind of tinkerings, we're very good at it. And no matter what antenna you've got, no matter how happy you are with it, bear in mind that you're going to be adding other antennas at a later time, favoring some other direction, favoring some other band, giving you more gain in some particular direction, giving you a higher angle or a lower angle of radiation, and so on. So, and don't worry about wire-like antennas. We amateurs, and we visit another ham, we all look up in the air, and we marvel about all the wire. The rest of the human race does not see wire. I'm very happy about that. I mean, of all the wire I've got up in the air, all my wife's friends that visit us, they see the walks they ride and they walk on. Sometimes they see the roof. They maybe see the lawn, but they don't see the wire up in the air. So don't worry about it. Good luck with that project. Let us know how it works out. Next guy on the list was Arnie, KD2 Charlie Tango India. Go right ahead, Arnie. K2LAW in the TechNet. Do wait for the four beeps.
Hi, Dick. No, I don't have anything particular to talk about tonight, but I am listening and enjoying it.
Arnie, maybe somebody is sleeping in your house. You were speaking extremely softly. Because I'm wearing earphones, I could hear you. I don't think anybody else heard you. And because you signed in, we thought you had a question. Okay, apparently you do not. The next person on the list was Jim. And Jim, you were a little bit noisy on your last transmission. But that's KD2PHY, I think it is. Let's hope that you are in a better location. If it's a handy you're using, that we'll hear you very well. KD2PHY, question mark, K2LAW in the TechNet.
KD2PHY, yeah, hi, Dick. I just had a question today. Actually, before I start, is my signal on?
You're 80% signal. 20% noise. I'm copying you very well. I'm afraid to have you make any change. It's good enough. Go right ahead and proceed with your question, Jim.
Yeah, I have a digital microphone that I got at a yard sale. The exact name and model is the Telex M560. And I got it at a yard sale for $10. And I was wondering if I could use it with my radio, and I know might be kind of a dumb question, but can I use a digital microphone on my TS-520?
Don, good question, and I don't know. So a Telex microphone, Telex digital microphone, Telex Mic 560, M560 is what I think you said. Let's see if we have anybody on frequency that knows what that product is and knows what's required to interface it with a Kenwood 520, a normal analog input type rig. And I've heard of very few digital microphones, but maybe I'm in the dark ages. So you smarter guys out there, maybe you know about this Telex digital microphone. Give us your call letters right now, K2LIW in the TechNet.
This is CPZ, I can maybe help.
Or Jack. Okay, there's a digital microphone man from way back. Go right ahead, Hal.
Most of the Telex mics were 500-600 ohm impedance, and they had to have bias on them. So if you could get the spec on the mic, which is a 600 ohm impedance mic, you have to have mic bias on it. You could get bias from the radio, and you could couple it into your 520. The first thing is contact Telex and get the documentation on the microphone. Interfacing it is no problem. If I remember correctly, it's low impedance. You have to put bias voltage to get it to talk.
Hal, is it likely that Jim will be able to find a website that has the data he's looking for as to properly how to interface the Telex digital microphone? Do you think he can get that on a website? And do you have a suggestion when he goes to? Or is he going to have to go directly to the Telex company? Over to you, Hal.
I'm not sure, Dick, about a website. I would say contact Telex directly and tell them the model of the microphone, and I'm sure they'll be more than happy to, you know, send them out or email a spec sheet on the microphone.
Now let me ask you, you a couple of questions, Hal. If it's called digital microphone, does that mean that from the actual diaphragm that absorbs the voice sound in the air, there is some kind of a digital circuit that does the gain, and does it after the gain with the digital circuit, is it then turned back into an analog signal in order to feed the rest of the transmitter? And if so, what is gained by the so-called digital function here? Over to you, Hal, K6DPZ, K2LAW.
Yeah, well, the ones I've seen, they use them in the high noise area. So it basically takes out a background noise and brings up the voice to be more usable in a high background area. That's why he has to get the spec on it, but I believe it is low impedance. He has to have bias on it, and he can make it work into a higher impedance input of that transceiver.
AC2QAQ with a comment.
Glenn recognized. And from what you just said, Hal, I'm going to now jump ahead and make some guesses. And that is, the digital function really means that built into the microphone, there is digital signal processing, which gives you a very fancy audio bandpass and filtering factor, and maybe even some spiky noise suppression. So there's where the digital function is coming in, is my guess. Let's see what Glenn's got to say on this one. KC2QIQ, K2LIW in the TechNet. Wait for the four beeps.
Yeah, I just reached over to my headset rack, Dick, and I have a Telex 510 for the headphones sitting right here. Next to that, on the rack, I've got Telex 560. Now, that's a headset with a boom mic on it, and it's got two end plugs on the end. but there's nothing on it that says digital. My question is, I mean, if that's the case, that microphone plugs into, you can get like the Heil adapters for the push-to-talk and other things like that, and you can plug it into virtually anything, and it just adjust the gain control and it works. Maybe it's a different model, but I'm wondering, is it the same as the 560 I'm holding in my hand right now?
Then it needs BIOS on it to make it work. It doesn't have a battery. It has to have BIOS in the equipment.
Jim did say it is Telex model M560. It sounds like he said Mic 560. Let's see. Get us some fills on this one, Jim. KD2, BHY, K2RIW, and a TechNet. Do wait for the four peeps.
Say Telex Mic 560, and on the packaging it said that it was a digital microphone. It's just a stand. It kind of looks strange. There's no headset with it, and on the end, which might be a problem, is instead of like a an audio plug, there's a USB plug, but I think that could be easily changed.
Oh, I know what that is now, Dick. Yeah, I don't think that there's a really good way of ever adapting that to amateur radio. But I think, yeah, that's a USB microphone mainly made for computer. That's for, like, computer conferencing. Very similar to the types of microphones you'd find on your computer to do recording locally or using Skype or something like that. KC2QIQ.
Now, let me give you a couple more questions on this one, Glenn. Many amateurs will buy a microphone that they really love, even though the connector on the end of it is absolutely wrong for their rig. And once they find out what wire is connected to what function in the microphone, to rewire it, either by making an adapter because you don't want to change what the molded, beautiful connector on the end of the mic, you either make an adapter or you dig into that connector and hardwire it to your favorite connector. So even though it is a USB-like connector intended for a computer, as long as Jim has enough information, what stops him from adapting that, maybe putting BIOS voltage on it, but what stops him from using that with the right kind of adapter into his Kenwood 520? KC2QIQ, wait for the four beeps, K2RIW and the TechNet.
VGB for comment.
Glenn first and then John. Go ahead, Glenn.
Yeah, well, basically, Dick, what happens, I think, with these, when you use microphones that are way out of the range of amateur use for the radio, like sometimes you can get away with using, like, Icon mics or Heil mics or even some studio mics. The problem is when you start using some of these, like the computer microphones, that the frequency response of the microphone, either it's just going to be, like, really, really dead sounding. Like when you're talking to it, everything will be super muffled. Or you get the other end of the extreme where it just everything sounds squeaky. But generally, the types of microphones, the cardioids and the standard amateur radio transceiver microphones, even there, between manufacturers, sometimes you have to be careful just to get the right audio frequency response. And it might just be more than adding a bias and other things. You might have to shape that audio with some kind of an equalizer or something to get it even close to in the ballpark. K2IW, KC2QIQ.
KD2CXK with a comment. CXK recognized. Okay, CXK and HF are recognized, but John is first in front of you guys. And even if an equalizer is required, nowadays an equalizer is a fairly inexpensive integrated circuit chip. Properly mounting it in a box may be a little bit of a hassle, but if it's too squeaky or too muffled, that quite often is correctable. See what John's going to say on this. KC2WGB, K2RIW in the TechNet.
KC2WGB. Yes, Dick, that 560 is a software speech recognition microphone intended for use in office where the noise level is high.
Will he be able to adapt that? No. I mean, even if the noise level in an office is high, and maybe it's squeaky or muffled or whatever, but with the right kind of audio equalizer function, John, do you believe that Jim will be able to get reasonable performance when he does things right and connects it to his Kenwood 520. Over to you, John, KC2WGB, K2LAW.
Well, Dick, besides supplying it with what it needs, I think he's going to have to do some trimming, just like Glenn said, because it's probably a very narrow band of frequencies that it's going to take, and it's not supposed to pick up room noise, from what I understand. So might he be able to adapt it? I'm sure, but I don't think the audio quality is going to be decent.
350Z info.
Okay, the E3, I think it was, the first guy on the list. The next person with a comment was Craig, I think it is, 82CXK. Go right ahead, Craig, K2LIW in the TechNet.
Good evening, Nick. Yeah, I've actually been through this not too long ago. If I understand, there's a USB end to that plug. That's actually the audio to USB encoder, for lack of a better term. That's actually the device in that plug that does the the digital conversion for USB. You would either have to cut that off completely, and now you'd have a pair of pins for the condenser microphone in that, or something that I've been working on, because I have a pair of Logitech computer headphones with a boom mic, is to plug them, and this is getting very adventurous, but could be a lot of fun, plugging them into a Raspberry Pi and taking that through the Shure audio program, which gives you an equalizer, and then gives you an analog output. So that's one option, and those things are about $50, and all the software's free. So that's the long way around, but could actually be beneficial.
Pretty good suggestion there, Craig, though it does sound like this could turn into quite a project for Jim, just to find various ways of using this microphone. Let's see what Dennis has got to say. NY2HM, I think it is. Dennis, give us as much audio as you can. It tends to be a little bit low. NY2HF, K2RIW, the TechNet. You got it, Dennis. I thought I heard NY2HF. Who was the person who signed in after Craig?
Right, Dick. I heard him in there also.
Toronto? Yeah, I hope Dennis hasn't been timed out. He's using the Eastern input, and sometimes it gets timed out. Let me do a double check on that. Okay, the Eastern input is operational. I just checked. NY2HF, K2RW. Go ahead, Dennis. Yeah, possibly IRLP, EchoLink, or whoever he's coming through is being locked out. The next person who signed in was BE3, and I should know who it is, but I know it was one of the BE3s. Go right ahead, sir. K2LAW in the TechNet.
This is BE3, Zulu Tango Zulu, Scott in Toronto. How copy me?
We're now copying you very well, Scott. ZTZ, K2LAW. Go ahead, Scott.
Hey, if that is a USB connection, a USB connector has four pins. Outer two, left and right, extreme left, extreme right, are the positive and negative voltage. Has to be applied to the circuitry that is somewhere in the connector or in the microphone or headset element. There's a circuit in there that takes the, processes the microphone into a digital signal. The companion piece you need for this is there's software that recognizes that microphone.
With an additional one as well.
Yeah, so I'm getting the impression from what what Scott just told us, making this microphone work is not going to be easy. John and Glenn in that order, got some further words here. KC2 WGB, K2RIW, go ahead, John.
Jim.
Joe, KD2 Echo Whiskey Oscar. Go right ahead, Joe, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Okay, the question I have is on grounding. Stranded insulated copper wire or bare copper wire and one or more grounding rods. And also, if you use the, I assume not, but would you use a separate penetration than the coax coming into the house?
Okay, Joe, when you come back to us, do whatever you can to give us more audio. Your audio, very clear, but very, very low audio, by whatever means you're coming in to us. The usual EIA standard for grounding for for lightning-like purposes and human safety is a 5/8 diameter rod, 8 feet long, either galvanized steel or copper clad, and then connected by way of a 6-gauge piece of wire is the usual EIA standard kind of grounding. Now, could you use a substitution for the braiding of a coax cable, for instance, what I think you're sort of asking? And yes, you can get as much conducting surface area by that technique, but it's not the usual approved technique by the EIA standard. I'm a little bit worried that they would be afraid that the ends would become mechanically frayed and not have as much longevity, so to speak, as a piece of 6-gauge wire with the right kind of interconnect device, if you know what I mean. So anyone else has some further comments on proper grounding, which is what Joe is really asking us about, give us your call letters right now, K2RIW in the TechNet. Okay, looks like no one has any strong disagreements on what I said, so in order to have a really approved ground that's up to code, so to speak, it would have to be somewhat like I said, and as you start making substitutes, I think you might not be up to code, Joe. KD2, Echo, Whiskey, Oscar, K2RIW in the TechNet. Wait for the four beeps and give us as much audio as you can, Joe.
A bare copper 6 wire. My question was, does it make a difference whether you use, instead of the number 6, bare copper wire, use a regular stranded 6 insulated wire, if there was a difference, or did it matter? And then one grounding rod, 3 grounding rods, 2 grounding rods?
Okay, yeah. Would 6-gauge stranded wire be good enough? Electronically, absolutely. I guess I'm not really sure whether or not the code would accept 6-gauge stranded as opposed to 6-gauge solid. There I don't know. Most people feel that 2 grounding rods is the right answer. There's nothing wrong with adding more, but 2 grounding rods, and one of the big variables, of course, is what is the soil like? And so a guy who wants to go the next step and be really quantitative will measure the impedance between the 2 grounding rods. And if you come up with a couple of ohms, you're home free. If your soil happens to be so sandy and so dry that between the 2 grounding rods you measure, let me pick a number, 100 ohms, then you don't have a very good ground. And adding more grounds and or putting chemistry around each one of those ground rods would be recommended. Very rarely do people on the East Coast have that problem. The people who live in the Mojave Desert do. The kind of loam soil that we have on the East Coast, that EIA standard 5/8 diameter, 8-foot long grounding rod usually gives you a good enough impedance, and 2 of them I think should be sufficient. Drag your feet a little bit when I pass it back to you, Joe, in case other people have a suggestion on this one. KD2 Echo Whiskey Oscar with some delay. K2RIW in the TechNet.
JB with a comment.
John recognized. Go ahead, John.
KC2 QIQ.
Run in that order. John first.
Okay, Dick. The question of the ground rod with braided wire or string.